Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debate in development studies.
So hello and welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. My name is Chris Jordan. I'm the communications manager for GDI. And today I'm joined by Francisco Ayala. Francisco has worked for the last 25 years on cash transfers, on social protection, on all things social safety net related. And he has just published a book with GDI's own David Lawson, called Cash Transfers for Poverty Reduction, an International Operational Guide. So, Francisco, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Chris. Yes, thank you for the invitation. And yes, I'm open for any question you may have about the book and what we've done.
Great. Well, I'm really interested to start off with your own background and your experience. As I say, you've worked 25 years in this field. You've worked in Kenya, Nigeria, Uganda, Tanzania, Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, Colombia, over 50 countries, I believe, on various programs. Could you just start by saying, how did you sort of get into this field in the first instance?
Well, perhaps, you know, it's kind of sometimes in life, coincidences happen. When I began my college studies, I did engineering. And then later, in my own country, Ecuador, I'm from Ecuador. And then I moved to the U.S. for doing the master's and PhD, but believing that I wanted to continue in engineering, but somehow, as always happens, I changed my mind. I got into these things of social aspects of life, and by coincidence, I ended up in Washington D.C. My university was very next to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and then, you know, working on these social aspects, I realized very quickly that because of my engineering background, that these institutions or these development agencies are very interested in evaluation, in policy making, those kind of aspects. But again and again and again, they were saying the programs were not being run correctly, were not actually being built correctly. And then I thought that, oh, this is perhaps a good target or a good niche where I can go and provide assistance. And that was the way that, you know, I ended up saying, why not? Let me do the engineering part of implementing these programs. And very quickly, I had a chance to start working in different countries. And as you mentioned, countries that typically had major problems with the implementation part of these programs.
And I'm guessing over the 25 years you've been working on these issues, you must have seen the agenda and interest and the whole sort of sector move a significant amount. How have things shifted from your perspective?
Well, let me tell you one thing, that perhaps in my case, I was lucky that I was able to see this niche in which not many people were interested. And why? Because, I mean, as you can imagine, people working in the social sector typically tend to be economists, even though I was doing a PhD in economics and public administration. But because of my engineering background, very quickly I realized that this niche, not many people were interested, not many people were working. And then for me, initially it was easy or relatively easy to go through and start working in these countries and understand the challenges they had. Or even for me it was a learning process over the years, you know, how is that these programs could be implemented. At the very beginning, telling you a little of history. What I learned at the very beginning, let's say 30 years ago, is that these social protection systems, the ones that are dealing with the poor and vulnerable people, they were designing and implementing programs that I call supply side programs. So the big gurus, the big consultants, the World Bank, the United Nations gurus, they upon the studies and whatever they did, they decided how, what to provide to the poor. Was this assumption that we knew more about the needs of the poor people? So then you know, these big consultants and experts were doing things. However, over the years, especially early 2000s, Duflo, the famous economist from MIT, said, hold on. I mean, all these experts are coming and saying, even though, of course, doing interviews and whatever, they were deciding what and how to help. Duflo said, hold on, I mean, but when is that we are going actually to listen and let people to decide what they want? How is that I decide, for example, in a cash transfer that I should provide $30 per month? But what about the decision of the beneficiary? Should be that the beneficiary needs the $30, $15, $40, or basically cash? So that was the next step, you know, to start working in how is that to complement the social protection systems, not only with supply side, but with demand side decisions, meaning providing and developing mechanisms to complement and say, okay, let's continue with supply side interventions, but now let's add let's facilitate the poor on what to decide, what to actually get in terms of services will be useful for them. And then lately, only the last decade, I would say, there is a new concept. And the new concept is what we call the adaptive social protection, meaning, you know, with the climate change, now we are facing a number of disasters and emergencies, and the frequency of them are becoming more and more important in our lives. In Africa, right now, I'm in Malawi, two, three emergencies per year in which people suffer because of the consequences of climate change, the droughts, the floodings, the typhoons. And then, you know, the latest is to coordinate the emergency response sector and the social protection sector to help the poor. But as you see, the more time over the years, the systems to help when the poor and vulnerable people have become more and more complex. And therefore also, engineerially speaking, more and more complex on the way to implement them. So, and this is where we are right now. At this stage.
Right, thanks. And I know we're talking to you this morning from, you're based in Malawi at the moment. Could you just run through briefly what you've been doing in Malawi?
Well, yesterday I had a meeting with the ministry, with the personnel of the ministry of, it's called here, the social ministry, it's called the Ministry of Gender in this country, but we were laughing about one thing, and let me share with you this anecdote. We were telling that in Malawi we are doing better than in Mexico. Remember, in Mexico, they are going through this disaster, that this hurricane in Acapulco, and destroyed a great deal of different parts of the city. The interesting part we were commenting yesterday is that in Mexico, the people in Mexico are saying they are not getting help, while the government is saying, yes, we are helping them. So what is the problem then? What is the disconnection? And yesterday in Malawi, I said, we found that disconnection, how to work You know why? Because that's the thing, that typically the systems, the social protection systems, are designed, you know, to help those that are already in the system. So the poor are receiving cash or assistance every month. When there is a disaster in the same area, yes, they can get a top up and then they are helped. But you know what? The ones that are not in the social protection system are for the disaster. Probably they were these small vendors, the ones with the small boats, the people, you know, that the low middle class working here and there and trying, you know, to build their lives. But the disaster came and everything was destroyed. And now they have nothing. But you know what's the problem? The government has no idea, no information about them. And they are the ones on TV, in the media, saying, we are not getting help. What in Malawi we did is to develop the systems in order to assist people that are not part of the social protection system. So when there is an emergency or disaster, right now there was actually a few weeks ago a cyclone here in Malawi and destroyed a great deal of the southern areas in the country with rains and flooding. So now we are in a program of over 200,000 households that were affected, utilizing the right mechanisms to help them, even though, especially for those that are not part of the regular cash transfer program of Malawi. So we are helping not only those that are already in the system, but those that before were okay, but because of the disaster, got nothing. So we are helping the both kind of people. Imagine, in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world, we are doing better than in Mexico. That is what was kind of the story yesterday. And this is what we are doing in Malawi, is that we are in this process of implementing with the assistance of the World Bank, over 200,000 households, is a program of over $20 million. But the point is to respond to the needs in record times, because people cannot wait months until the help comes.
Great to hear. And good luck with the implementation. I wanted to turn now to the book specifically, Cash Transfers for Poverty Reduction. I've had a look through it. It's an epic tome. You've written it's almost 500 pages long. You start off with the big concepts around cash transfers and safety nets, and you know the broad sort of policy debates. But then you really get into really granular detail about exactly how people should think about setting programs up and different elements of the program. So tell me, what was your inspiration for writing the book in the first place?
Well, look at the what I told you at the very beginning is that why is that I got into this niche and was able to be able to work in many countries, perhaps up to now over 50. Even, you know, I was almost kidnapped in countries like Nigeria, Yemen, Colombia. But this is what we do. Or perhaps, you know, let me do this to make it easy for our audience. What is that we are trying to do? There are many books about cash transfers at this point. You see the cash transfer programs actually started in the 1990s, late 1990s, with initially in Mexico and Brazil, the concept was developed and more and then conditionalities. But the books you find, the papers you deal with are more related with policy making. And the policy making is with the idea of whether actually this program should be implemented. The more and more we are going, the more countries are implementing them, over 140 right now. And then, of course, after the policy making, also a number of books came up about, telling about the evaluations and the architecture of these programs. When I say architecture means the design parameters, how much we should provide, what would be the eligibility criteria for the poor, for the households, what would be the exit policies, until when we should pay them, what would be the payment. But you know, this kind of books and papers that were developed before is answering the what. What is that? What could be the design parameters of these programs? And these programs actually were based upon the evaluations. But you know what? The evaluations, as I explained before, came always, everything is okay, but the problem still is operations, is the how. The operational part, the implementation part, still is very poor. And this is what I've been doing. And then there is no single book, I would say, up to now, in the market dealing with that part, the engineering part, explaining the audience, explaining the ministry officers, the students, about how is that the engineering detail you should take into consideration in order to improve your designs. Already the policy makers, already the evaluations told you what should be done. But the question is how to do it, because you are dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars. And in every sector, the electricity, civil, all the sectors, they have even full universities, departments, PhDs, engineering, etc., dealing with these aspects. But you know what? In the social sector, nothing. Well, that's perhaps an exaggeration, but very little. Even at the University of Manchester or any other university, check any course saying, I'm going to teach the engineering of how to implement these programs, you don't find them. And this is the inspiration of this book. Perhaps maybe a little boring for policymakers or for consultants doing you know the answering the questions of what, but this is oriented for students who are interested in the engineering part, and this is the typical aspect that actually people or authorities in governments are looking for, trying to hire them in order to have the necessary capital resource or the resources, the human resources, you know, to provide this assistance in order to make these programs more efficient, cost effective, and engineeringly part. So it's like when you build a house, I mean, it was fine until the architects are okay. They can actually design a very nice house. But in order to have a good house, you need engineers, the civil engineers. This is the same in the social protection sector. So this book actually answers or try to answer those aspects. As you can imagine, the engineering has many aspects to deal with. We in the book, we took some of the basic ones. Perhaps if we see that the book is utilized, we'll go into subsequent editions, adding more aspects on these aspects. So that's part of the reason that is a long book, over 500 pages, and took us about over 5 years to build it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and you mentioned engineering. So at the top of the book, you sort of explicitly call for the need for social protection engineers. So could you say a little bit more about what you mean? What's the call for social protection engineers?
Yes. Let me give you one. The experience that we are having right now is that, over 200,000 households were affected, families. If you multiply by five, then it's 1 million people. And then the very basic thing you need to do is first register them. You need to register. And you have to register them in record time, let's say a week, 2 weeks. So the engineering part means how then I should come up with the logistics? The number of material, people, time, also consider, I mean, how long we need these people that already is affected to have in the register process. We don't want them to do queues or spend days waiting for somebody to register them. We want them to spend very little time. That's the engineering part, is, you know, is to organize these massive processes in record times, being very efficient and very client-oriented, like in any other process that you see. So even when you go to movies, you know, or you go to a big concert or to a main match in England to see Manchester United, well, they are not that good now. But the thing is that you don't want people to wait in queues. You want to move them smoothly through the seats. The same for us. And that is the engineering part. This is what. And of course, that needs to be supported by systems, by software applications. And those software applications need to be developed, need to be developed with security. Not only that, we need to train the officers, but for that we need to provide the guidelines, how to do or what to do. And as you can imagine, when you register 200,000 families, there are many what ifs. What if the person didn't bring the ID? What if only children come? What if the mother doesn't speak the language? What if? So those answers need to be, those questions need to be designed, the answers, so that when the time comes to implement those aspects, all those aspects need to be in place so you can have a smooth process. So that's engineering. That is the one where, when we say engineering, that's what we are talking about.
Thanks. And you mentioned complexity earlier. Is there also a role for the social protection engineer around trying to reduce complexity? I think, you know, there's quite often a tendency to stack programs on top of one another. What's your take on that?
Well, still there is this debate, especially in countries like this, Malawi. Should we introduce high level technology to help beneficiaries here in Malawi, when the access to internet or the access, you know, to complicated and sophisticated cell phones is not there? What is the kind of engineering that should be applied when at the same time you have different programs running? And as I said before, more sophisticated concept, which is called adapted social protection. Now what we are trying is to make the two sectors, the disaster response sector and the social protection, work together. Over the years, the shock response sector, typically they are very preoccupied. The objective is to reduce casualties, to reduce victims. So they are always, you know, preparing for the disaster, telling, alerting, doing this kind of designs to actually protect and reduce the risk of people when the disaster arrives. But after that, they are not much interested. What happens? Nevertheless, even though you do all this, you see that when you face a disaster, there are many casualties, destruction, and many people affected. What to do with them? So what this sector says is, oh, the social protection should take care of them. But as I told you with the example of Mexico, look at what happened what is happening right now in Turkey with a major disaster that happened a few months ago with over 50,000 people dead. Is that, yes, 50,000 people dead, but 500,000 people with nothing. What to do with them? But the majority of them are not in the system, are not the regular beneficiaries, but then they have to be included. How fast the social protection can do so, and how can coordinate with the emergency response sector in order to help people? So the complexities are getting bigger and bigger, and you see, because of this lack of work to working together, this lack of coordination, you see the TV, you see the news all the time, people complaining and complaining because they are not receiving the proper help. because the sectors are not properly prepared and adequately prepared, you know, to respond to this kind of situations. And this is what we are trying to work. And, but of course, as you can imagine, you got to go with the, what we call the bureaucratic inertia, meaning that governments and ministries and agencies are not really, you know, with this anxious sense of solving all these processes in order to be better prepared. Typically, they respond when already the disaster is there. And I'm not talking about countries like Malawi. All types of countries, even developed countries, have and face the same challenges. Look at what is happening in Mexico. So this is our, I would say, our main challenge these days is to get better prepared, because the climate change is telling us that the frequency of disasters, emergencies, are increasing. So we need really to develop this sense of resilience among the poor and the sectors be prepared to answer properly into this kind of emergencies that are happening day after day.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that we saw in almost all countries around the COVID response, right? Particularly northern countries in the UK. You know, this isn't just a kind of emergency response to natural disasters or climate, right?
Yes, exactly. Look at what happened back now that you are talking about the COVID in Malawi. When the cities shut down, the countries shut down mid-2020, I think, yes. But well, what is the problem? Well, at least in the case of developed countries, middle-income countries, we had the means, you know, to survive, to go through, to stay at home, to get the food, etc. But in the poor countries, those kind of mechanisms were not there. So when the cities were shut down, immediately, a month after, we saw and realized that actually people had they were hungry. The food was not there, because it's the kind of persons that they buy every day, and then the food was not delivered from the rural area. So then these are the aspects that you have actually to take care and be prepared. In the case of Malawi, I remember we developed we put in place this cash transfer program for cities, and actually we were able to provide assistance only about 6-9 months after the disaster. And that was very late, because nobody was prepared. But the thing is that, of course, the good news was that the deaths, the deaths rate in Africa was relatively low with respect to what happened in America or in Europe. And then many violations happen in Africa, including in Malawi, because people had to move, you know, migrate into the rural areas in order to survive. But imagine if that was not the case. Imagine if the death rates are similar or were similar to what happened in America and Europe. Then the story would have been completely different. And what if the next disaster happens that, you know, the death rate in Africa ends up being much higher, or in any Latin American country, much higher than what was in the last one, like COVID. So these are kind of aspects that need to work. And then for that, you need technology, processes, engineering, have the instruments ready in order to be prepared to react to this kind of situations that we know are going to happen. We are the probabilities are very high, are getting higher and higher every day. So what we are trying with our book is trying to provide the instruments, you know, for students to actually later get experience, develop, and help their own countries, agencies, in order to cover and answer these kind of needs.
Thanks. I know you're a busy man. There's one last question I wanted to ask you, which is around digital and mobile technologies. I'm sure this is something that must have changed spectacularly over the last even just 5 or 10 years. And yet it must be very context specific. How do you think about sort of balancing efficiencies against access around, the use of mobile money or mobile registration systems?
Yes, let's talk about money. Look at the thing is 10 years ago, I remember we were discussing about how to adapt technology to the needs of these countries like in Asia or Latin America or Africa. At some point, I remember an anecdote. I used to tell the experts, say, look at that. The problem of using cell phones in either in rural areas, either in Asia or in any of these poor countries, doesn't matter the continent. You know what? 50% of the head of the household heads or the wives, in case the money was oriented to them, more than 50% needed glasses. I don't know if you have glasses, but in my case, yes, I wear glasses. So how you can expect that if over 50% of them need glasses and don't have it, are going actually to read and check what in the cell phone is all about? So this was for us a big question, a big wondering, what we should do then? We cannot use mobile technology only just because of that. So what we learned over the years is that we adapted to whatever is available, because the private sector in technology, they go for whoever is willing to pay. They never design for the poor. There is no money. The World Bank or this or the FID or any of these developing agencies are not really, paying attention with this kind of aspects, because first are expensive, and second, the technology has its own characteristics and speed and moving. So what we realized later is that we have to adapt to whatever is available. So look at the case, for example, in some of the countries in Africa, is that yes, the payments are using mobile. We do through mobile systems, meaning that we transfer the money to the cell phone. But 90% of our beneficiaries don't have cell phones. So you know what we provide to them? We provide SIM cards. So what they have instead of a paper saying that they are entitled for money, what they get is a SIM card. So that SIM card, but the next thing we have to do with them is tell them that SIM card is going to give you a given amount of money in such a date, and then you gotta go to the small shop in whatever community there, few kilometers or hundreds of meters away, and then get into the cell phone of that small shop, and then the guy who is doing the shop reads, according to the password and username, reads the money entitled for the beneficiary, and that person is obliged to give the beneficiary whatever amount of money. Once the transaction ends, the SIM card is returned to the beneficiary. This is an adaptation. Well, in that situation, what is that our preoccupation is? Don't accept any discount. Make sure that you will receive such an amount and keep yourself the SIM card. But still, we were able to do mobile payments when 90% don't have cell phones. So we are doing that actually, the more technology comes, we are adapting and making and coming with ways, the best ways, using the technology available, state of the art, adapting to what our beneficiaries, our poor people, actually can do with it.
And that seems like a great example of the sort of granular detail that the book gets into in terms of all the different issues, the practical effects, the just the steps that people really need to think about when they're trying to implement these kind of cash transfer or social safety net programs. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Francisco. It's a really interesting book. I know I really loved both the detail that it gets into, but also the case studies and the examples, the real world examples that you put alongside it, which I think helps bring it to life and give it sort of context and resonance. So we'll put a link to the book in the notes to this podcast, and hopefully people can also find a blog and other material on the GDI website, which will give you a bit more of a sense of what's in the book. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Francisco.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chris. And I really appreciate this conversation. My hope, to tell you the truth, is that with this kind of book, universities like Manchester, or like University of Manchester and others that are very in deep and preoccupied with the social sector, having so many masters, is to start including these kind of courses in which, you know, they will be able not only to train them in policy making and architecture, but also architecture of these programs, but also, you know, in the engineering of how to actually implement these programs. The book includes, like a typical textbook, includes exercises for students, so then teachers can actually take advantage of that. And hopefully that would be great if there is any metric or indicator to say that the book was successful, is that in a few years, I'll be able to see courses doing engineering for social protection. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Francisco. Bye.